good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, May 15th, 2013, and I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And today, for the entire hour, we have with us Eleanor Lipman. Eleanor is the author of 10 novels, including The Inn at Lake Divine and of Tweetland and Liberty, Irreverent Rhymes from the Political Circus. She's with us this morning to talk about her current books, The View from Penthouse B, a novel, and I Can't Complain, All Too Personal Essays. Eleanor lives in New York City, and she's on the phone. Hi, Eleanor.
Hello. Hi.
Hi. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
I've been spending time with your books for the last week or so, and it's been quite a pleasure. And I so want to hear you talk about, well, both of them, but let's begin with The View from Penthouse B. I'd love to hear how the book came about.
Sure. It's time to start a new novel, and that happens. And I had this notion, it was sort of a little recession-based, I thought. It was just sort of the zeitgeist recession. So I had this idea about some people. It was going to be unrelated people sharing an apartment, and there was the sort of the host owner, who was named Margot, and so I won't go into any detail because that sort of fell by the wayside. I kind of ran out of steam, couldn't get the car in the garage, so to speak. And then things were going on in my life. My husband was very sick. So I put that aside, and then 6 months went by, and I thought, I know, I will sort of cannibalize from that. I will keep the apartment, keep the penthouse, keep it on West 10th Street in Greenwich Village. Margot will now still be the homeowner and host, but it'll just be Margot and her newly, not so newly widowed sister. And Margot has been Madoffed, as a friend of mine put it. She has, she's been divorced, and she had a good-sized settlement and lost it all, as I say in the first page, to the Ponzi schemer whose name we do not utter. So that's the setup. And then I had, you know, pretty much, that was, for me, that's enough of a plot. To move forward with, I should say. No, there's more to the plot, but to me that's enough to start with.
Well, what was also interesting was reading the novel along with the essay collection, because you have a section in the essays about writing and an essay in particular about not plotting. So that was really interesting because you had so many twists and turns in the novel that I am curious about your process, I guess. I mean, you have enough to start with, and then how do you get your plot points? Do you think of what would be sort of the most bizarre thing that could happen at this point, or what would be the most natural thing that would happen at this point?
You know, I don't think in terms of plot points. I think in terms of storytelling, what moves the story along. Sometimes I go down a blind alley, and then I think with the experience of this is my 10th novel, I am good at judging when I'm going down a boring alley, or I always quote, I forgot his name. I always quote Elmore Leonard, who said, I try to leave out the parts that people skip.
Yeah.
So I do that too. So what I do is just, the day's work ahead of me is thinking, what next? And it has to be interesting. I don't want it to be outlandish. So I want it to be realistic, yet interesting and fun and entertaining, but still plausible. Plausible / entertaining.
Yeah. So early on, and I don't think this is giving anything away because it's very early on, the ex-husband shows up.
Yes,
and
he does.
I wondered if you were as surprised as I was.
Yes, you're catching on to my methodology here. Yes, and that's when I get to quote Robert Frost saying, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. Mm-hmm. Yes, this happens when something suddenly turns up in the novel. And I once saw Doctorow being interviewed on the Dick Cavett show, E.L. Doctorow, mm-hmm. about Ragtime, and Dick Cavett said, so suddenly there's Houdini or Emma Goldman, and what happened? And he said, Doctorow said, well, there was a knock at the door, and my character got up and answered it, and it was Emma Goldman. So with the ex, I was sort of planting the seeds and didn't know it, because he was in jail for fraud. He practiced what I called in the book amorous medicine. And so he's been in nice white collar comfy prison not for malpractice, but fraud, because he, and this is right in the first chapter, so I'm not giving, this is not mm-hmm. a big reveal,
right.
that he had inseminated, it, you know, he's a fertility doctor, and he had inseminated a lot of patients the old-fashioned way. But his secretary charged them for artificial insemination, and so ultimately they got him for fraud. So I knew it was a sentence of X number of months, and he had to turn up sometime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was glad he turned up.
Yeah, that was necessary.
Yeah, it was necessary. It's interesting. It was an interesting twist. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Eleanor Lippman, and we're talking about The View from Penthouse B. Going along in the book, I loved that that you have a character who is working on has a guidebook idea. And I thought it was such a fun guidebook idea, and I wondered if it was a project you wanted to do.
Are you talking about what not Margot's?
The guidebook, the memoir guidebook idea. I think it's on like page 79 or something.
Thank you. Because as opposed to Gwen's harebrained scheme to have a dating service for the modest.
Well, that too, and I want to talk about that too.
Oh, yeah, you know, I have to say, in all truthfulness, the guidebook that Margot had come up with was, it's kind of, I just nibble around the edges of that, because I think the reader knew it was, it's presented right from the beginning as a lousy idea. The two mm-hmm. characters mm-hmm. listen to her, you know, her lame brain scheme about this book that would be about, you know, in the recession for her fellow scammed friends. And, you know, and it's the most obvious things, like take books out of the library instead of buying them, or dye your own hair, or things like that. So I didn't approach that with much seriousness, because when she tells Gwen about it and the other roommate, Anthony, who I actually, if you did ask me to read, I was going to read a little bit about Anthony, they can't, you know, it's a lousy idea she has. Just like Gwen's idea about chaste dates is a lousy idea. But that's more fun to write than a good idea.
Right, right. I would love to hear you read, and this would be a great time, will you?
I will, and there's the two sister roommates, and for financial reasons, they take in another boarder, and his name is Anthony, and he's 29 years old. So this is just a few minutes about Anthony.
Okay.
And this is Gwen. This is Gwen Laura's narrator of the whole book, so this is she talking. He's happy here, and he is easy to have around, both thoughtful and helpful. He's freed us from stereotyping and hating men who have anything to do with Wall Street or wealth management. He went under with Lehman Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
As far as being handy, he has exceeded our expectations. In the first 24 hours of his residency, he put batteries in our remote control, set our clocks ahead to daylight savings time, and gave new life to what we thought was an inoperative ice maker. He always has the right cable needed for various transfers of information that we didn't even know we wanted. He has a headset that allows him to talk to his far-flung friends while sitting at his computer. He is the king of uploading and downloading, of searches and hunts. He likes his room, or at least its location, on the other side of the kitchen, somewhat segregated. When he's home, we often find him in the kitchen island, on a stool with his laptop and vitamin water. Praying at the altar, he says with a smile. He bakes a double batch of cupcakes every week, some for us, and the rest of, as offerings to his dates. I'm not sure where he meets these young ladies, but he must, wherever he goes. His phone vibrates and barks fairly constantly. He's exceedingly polite in our presence. Whatever calls, emails, and texts pour in, Anthony doesn't return them until dinner and conversation conclude. Do you want me to go on?
Yeah, please.
Okay. He asked both of us after weeks under our roof if we dated. He hadn't noticed too much traffic of that variety coming or going. None of my business, of course, he added. I don't mind answering his questions, which would be awkward if he was a man my age instead of the kid in running shorts and flip-flops eating leftover Chinese food straight from the refrigerator. His youth provides the comfort level. He's like a teaching assistant in a psych course called Spinsterhood. So I admit, I might be a candidate for chase dates myself, but less so now than a year ago. Margot yells to him from the dining room, "Now tell us who you were out with last night." "The lucky lady who got the pink cupcakes," I add. Anthony does a very sweet thing at this moment. He takes me by the hand and leads me into the dining room where he says, "Please be seated." I do, but he continues to stand. Chinese food abandoned in the kitchen. He says solemnly, "I just realized when Margaret asked me who I went out with last night that I've put you on the wrong track." "Which is what?" I ask. "Let me put it this way. Young ladies don't appreciate cupcakes. They're all on diets. They dump them or re-gift them." He pauses, smiles. "On the other hand, dudes scarf them down." Margot and I are still smiling expectantly, not realizing that announcement is whole and complete, if not eloquent. "Hmm," he says with a theatrically perplexed hand to his chin. "I see that I haven't made my point." "You're not going to be baking cupcakes anymore?" I ask. Anthony says, "Let me put it this way, dear ladies, I'm gay. I thought you might have guessed that already, but apparently not."
Thank you so much. That was Eleanor Lippman reading from The View from Penthouse B. And as you were reading, I was thinking about something I was thinking about as I was reading the book, and that was that you have such a facility for dialogue. And I wonder if it's always been there, or if you had to train yourself to hear how people speak and get that into fiction so that it's believable.
You know, I get asked this question a lot, and it's always it's always slightly embarrassing to answer it because it does come very easily to me. And when I write a scene, it usually starts with it's the bare bones of it is the dialogue. And my former editor, was my first editor and turned into the fabulous Pulitzer Prize winning biographer Stacy Schiff, who did Cleopatra mm-hmm. and won the Pulitzer for Vera about Mrs. Nabokov. Anyway, Stacy, marvelous editor, and she once read a scene I'd written where it was Isabel's bed and they're all sitting around the table talking, and she wrote in the margin, "Could someone here please pass the potatoes?" So what I have to do is I write the dialogue, and it just, I hear it, and I write it, and then I trim it. I always try. I follow the advice of David Mamet, quoting William Goldman, the screenwriter, which is to get into a scene as late as possible and get out of it as early as possible. So I keep covering up the first few lines to see how far down I can start and take out the throat clearing and the hellos, how are you, have a seat. But it does, and I use dialogue to move the story along. And it's the other part is harder for me, the exposition, the description. I just want the salient detail. And so, you know, I say sort of apologetically, you know, sorry, that does come easily. I hear it. And it also means I do have a very good memory for dialogue because, as, you know, people who know me a test. You know, I can say, no, that's not what you said. You said this.
That's great. I suppose all writers have their sort of strengths and weaknesses, and being able to find what they are or what it is perhaps part of maybe the key to continuing on when you're writing, especially when you're beginning writing.
You know, I would say yes, but I think I never thought, oh, look, I'm good at dialogue, so my story will be moved forward by the dialogue. It's mm-hmm. just what came naturally. I'm so not a natural describer. I don't like to read a lot of description at all. Another former editor of mine once talked about a book that she loved and gave to her son, who was 11, 12, and she came home and said, what'd you think of that book? And he said, too much wind in the trees. I think that sums up many books. So it's not as if I use that and think, well, let me use that particular talent. It's just what I'm most comfortable with. You know, it's often too much of it, so I have to throw in, you know, I have to, like, please pass the potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I started writing, thinking I was in a writing workshop at Brandeis Adult Ed, and the teacher, who's a wonderful teacher named Arthur Edelstein, who died a few years ago, he had to say to me, you know, it's good to break up the dialogue, have your character, you know, pick up a glass and take a sip or take a, you know, bite on a radish or something. So I had to be told that. Speaking of, you know, yeah.
Well, had you ever considered writing plays? I mean, was that ever a part of that extension?
You know, once way back in a former life, I did write a play with a co-worker. We were both working for the Mass Teachers Association. So, and we were also neighbors, so we would get together in my dining room. And we worked on a play, and it got as far as honorable mention for the Mass Council of the Arts thing. But I would like to. I think of it, but... You know, part of it is my day job is writing novels, and, yeah, so mm-hmm. I think of it, and this novel and the last one, The Family Man, people have said they have, you know, theatrical qualities, which I think it means it's kind of set in one place.
Yeah, interesting. Well, you know, speaking of being set mostly in one place, the title, at what point did the title come along?
The title, not too soon. At one point, one of the Margot brags to her sister or to someone. She says, "Just we live in Penthouse B," and I thought of that as not a great title, but something like "We live in Penthouse B." It's a first person narration, and I tried it out on a neighbor who has nothing to do with the writing. She was just visiting for coffee. And I said, what do you think of this title? And she thought, and she sort of closed her eyes, and she said, The View from Penthouse B. So I said, Eureka. And I was so sure of it that I sent it, you know, one has to get the approval. It's not just your agent and your editor, but the marketing and sales force and all that stuff. So I sent it to the head of publicity and my publicist, and I said, here, I have my title. Here it is. And then I wrote, see, did you notice I'm using psychology? I didn't ask you if you liked it. I just pronounced it my title, and everybody liked it.
Yeah, and did you have another working title before? Did you just start?
I did not.
No, you just were writing the novel.
Writing the novel. The only novel of mine that came titled, it was the working kind of document title, was The Inn at Lake Divine. And a good friend, a wonderful novelist, Suzanne Strumpeck-Shea, I just sort of mentioned it, and she said, that's it. This was just a few chapters into it. That's the title. And that was, everybody was happy with that.
Interesting. We are going to take a very short break and be right back with more Eleanor Littman, so don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. We gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, woman's built me day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
Listen to Writers on Writing every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. And this broadcast, along with many, many, many others, is available as podcast a week or so after it's on the air, sometimes a little later than a week or so, depending on how many other things are going on. But you can access the archive at writersonwriting.blogspot.com and also find shows at penonfire.com, which also talks about many other kind of writerly things going on in the area, as well as just writerly stuff in general. We have a Pen on Fire speaker series coming up, not for a while. It's in July. Chris Bojalian is going to be in town, so he will be doing a noon event with us on July 18th. You can find out more about that at penonfire.com. Let's bring Eleanor back on. You still there?
I am. Thank you.
Excellent. You know, along the lines of what you said earlier about the child saying too much wind in the trees.
Yes.
I was curious, sort of a long, sort of winding question about setting, because I love the beginning of the novel. I find it quite minimal, and the scene setting is to me perfect. There's very little. It's you know, something about the Art Deco building, the Batavia, and it gave me a picture. I don't know if it's because I've been to New York, I'm from the East Coast, or what? It just seemed perfect. And so I am wondering about you and setting, how important it is to you. And do you, when you write about New York, since you mostly live in New York, do you try to see New York as a stranger would see it? How do you get the setting just right?
Oh, thank you. I've only been full-time in New York for two and a half years. So I do see it as not so much a stranger, but as a sort of resident honeymooner. You know, that's how I see it, that it's just still new and, you know, just like the old, I say this in one of the essays, it's sort of the, you know, the New York of, you know, sort of a Gershwin tune. I see this sort of romanticized New York. But I don't see myself as good at settings. I think I do the minimal amount. I'm certainly not good at the, you know, the furnishings. I sort of, one of the few things I say about the apartment is that it has dimensions, that there's long hallways so that you can't see what's happening at one end, that is what happening at the other. And I like to leave that stuff up to the reader's imagination and supply just enough, just a little bit. I had, when I was touring with The Family Man, which was set, my first New York book, and it was set on the Upper West Side on West 75th, and there was a little girl in the audience, and she had to be 7 or 9 or 8 years old, and she raised her hand and she said, "How did you do that? That I got it exactly, exactly right. So right." And I said, "Oh, where did you live in New York?" And she said, "I don't really know. I was 3 when I moved." I forgot to say this is in California. So I thank you for saying that, but I leave it. I do the minimal amount, and I don't. You know, I don't want to overdo it. Too much wind in the trees, mm-hmm. and as I said, I'm always talking about the salient details.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. It worked for me.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I love setting. I love detailed setting as well, but I also like minimal, especially if the right details. I think you have to choose the right details, and I think that's what you do.
Thank you. I did, as in further self-regard here, I got an email from a woman who's lived her, someone I know, a friend, and she is 70 and has lived in New York her entire life. And she said, you know, how did you get it so, the feeling, everything of New York, right? And I said to her, my characters leave the apartment at approximately 3 times in the whole novel. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how you think I got a great feel for New York. So, you know, when I'm not someone who's a student of my own work,
mm-hmm.
you know, sometimes people want you to be able to answer the questions that, and so I end up saying, you know, I'm not a student of my own work. I only write it.
That's good. You know, I was wondering because a little piece came out this weekend in Parade, a little blip on the books, which I very much noticed, and you have something coming up next weekend in the New York Times. And so I was curious how, if you track how these things affect your sales. I mean, do you get on Amazon? And
I don't. I don't. And it's this weekend, we can now say, in the New York Times. It's the 19th, mm-hmm. and it's... I'm completely thrilled about that upcoming thing. I don't. And I have friends who say, so how's the book doing? Books, in this case. And I say, I don't know. I don't. You know, you learn over the years what makes you nervous, what you should be spending time thinking about. And before I even had my first book published, I was lucky enough to do an event with Tracy Kidder in Western Mass, where I still am there part-time and, you know, lived there for a really long time and raised my son there. And he said, I told him that my first book was coming out and it was short stories and I was really nervous. And he said, can I give you a little advice? And I thought, how sweet. Of course you can give me, you Pulitzer Prize winning Tracy Kidder. And he said, there's sales and reviews and bestseller lists, and then there's the writing. And everything else is everything else, and you should be just thinking about the writing. And he has said also, when you're working, when a book is not that, when a book comes out, you should be working on the next thing.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
So I've taken that to heart, and mm-hmm. good news comes to you, where your publisher will say, "Oh, there's been a, you know, there was just a." Right after the New York Times, it's not out yet, but they see it early and said there was a, you know, very large new order from Barnes & Noble. So you hear lovely things like, you hear mm-hmm. things like that, with due respect to all my independent bookstore friends. You know, going back to press, you hear about that. So I wait for the good news to come to me.
Yeah, because you could spend half your life, really, you know, tracking this stuff. off? To what end?
I went to a book party for a dear friend who I won't mention her name, and the introducer said, talked about how nervous she was, and she said, they said, this is someone who reads like book blogs from Zimbabwe. This is a New York writer, and we all laughed knowingly, like, boy, does she ever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Now, you know, speaking of the book of essays, I can't complain, all two personal essays. Why were the two books brought out at the same time? I found that a little unusual.
It's very unusual.
I was very happy about it.
It turned out to be a very good idea because almost every place is reviewing them together, and as my next-door neighbor, the Tony Award-winning composer, Mari Yestin, told me, he said happily, as I was signing a book for him, it's an event. Two books makes it an event. So I loved that. What happened was I submitted the essays, and my wonderful publisher, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, said to my agent, well, we will publish these, but we'd like a novel, too. Mm-hmm. And no thought, I didn't think, well, they mean at the same time. And then someone made that decision, and it was going to be paperback essays and hardcover novel. And then, as my editor said, and that the read it got in-house was very enthusiastic, and the sales force said it should be hardcover and not paperback. And as my editor recently explained, too, because I said, people are asking me this, I better have an answer, and she said, there's a conversation between the two books.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is. And that's especially why I was happy to have both at once, because, you know, I mentioned earlier about your section on writing, and then, you know, other sections too that sort of tie in with the book and your how your life overlaps or doesn't overlap with the novel.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah. So your voice is very singular. It's the voice of the novel to me is the same voice as the voice of the essays. And so I wonder if your voice is always your voice, or do you really try to do something different with each book? I'm getting your other novels now because I like this one so much, and I'm curious mm-hmm. as to what I'm going to find. I mean, what do you have to say about voice and
yeah, I actually have an answer for this one. Still not a student of my own work, because when I wrote, The Inn at Lake Divine is about a Jewish family being turned away from a restricted hotel. And to me, and I'm going to grab and just read the opening sentence because okay. It sort of says it all. Let's see. Turn the page here. It begins, it was not complicated and, as my mother pointed out, not even personal. They had a hotel. They didn't want Jews. We were Jews. And so this is, as my friends called it, you know, the revenge of the Jewish girls, in terms of this young woman is narrating it, and she's turned away, families turned away from a restricted hotel in the early 60s before the Civil Rights Act, when you could still do that legally, and then she returns as an adult and gets involved with the family. So my agent called it the revenge of the Jewish girls. So when I presented it to her, I said, you know, this is different. This is, first of all, we have this weighty topic of anti-Semitism. So then, you know, the first thing I heard was like, oh, it's so funny. So I thought, what? So I came to realize that, and people said this, you know, it's still your voice. And so I just accept it, and I don't try, even when I try with story and characters and plot to make everything different, but I know what readers value is the voice, so I don't, I can't, I accept it, and I'm happy with it, and so I've gone into like a little modesty rotary here, so I can't get out of it.
Okay, we'll get out of it. I have another question for you. And by the way, you're all listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Eleanor Lippman, and we're talking about her essay collection, I Can't Complain, All Too Personal Essays, and The View from Penthouse B. So, in an interview on the Barnes & Noble website, you talk about not writing what you know, but making it up. And so I'm curious, because there is overlap in your novel with your life to some degree, to maybe a teensy degree, but to some degree. And so can you talk about that, like jumping off from real life into fiction?
I can. Actually, I could only say that in the past, which is that I could proudly proclaim that I made everything up. And that I learned very early, because my first book was short stories, and in it there was a story that really, I borrowed the character from someone I knew. She was the most obsequious person I'd ever met. She apologized for everything, and the story begins something like, when I meet Claire in the market, a made-up name, and ask her a question about herself, a thank you note arrives in the next day's mail. And that is what she was like. So I wrote that thinking it was for a writing class. Nothing had ever been published of mine, so I was safe. Anyway, ultimately, it appeared in my short story collection. I didn't even think it should be in there, but the lawyers said, lawyers for the publishing house, Viking, said, that's the most universal character in the book. Everyone knows her. But I learned my lesson, because I got a very unhappy, nasty, angry letter from that woman. So I said, never again, to myself. But this one, now I can say, no, nothing's autobiographical. The Inn at Lake Divine, it begins the jumping off point. That did happen. My family got a letter in the early 60s from a restricted hotel that said, the people who come here year after year and feel most comfortable are Gentiles. So that's where I got that. But The View from Penthouse B, I just threw it all away, all my, protests about it not being, that I made it all up. When I threw away the first iteration of it and then made the character, the narrator, a widow, it was because it was 6 months after my husband died, and I thought it was all fiction because my character's husband had died 2 years before, and so that had nothing to do with me, I thought. And then, of course, it takes a while to write a book, so I caught up with her. and then it came, I thought I had to, put her out there, push her out of the house, because I thought this is going to be a very static book. Mm-hmm. If she never leaves the apartment, so I had to, send her out and, I had to send her out on dates.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Thank you for dropping it there.
That's good. That's good. I would love to hear you read from the essay collection.
I will. I had picked out a part about not outlining, but I could think if I've sort of covered that too much, I could read, there's something called a writer's anxieties, a guide.
Right.
Your author's anxieties.
Yeah.
That'd
be great.
I read this recently. I spoke to the Massachusetts Library Association, and many of them, of course, put on events. And I wrote this I was invited to the National, what's it called? It's in Washington, D.C. on the Mall, and it's this big writer's thing. And I couldn't go. I was actually had a one-month fellowship somewhere. So I said I couldn't go, and they said, well, could you write an article about going to a writer's festival? So this is the last part of it, which is said, lies to tell an author who is looking forlorn, unloved, unpurchased. One, I've always meant to read your work. Everyone else I know has. Two, my book group is doing, title of novel you're not buying, in February. In fact, I'm going to be the facilitator. I love your website. Three, I own every one of your books but didn't bring them today. I look forward to your next one. And then guidelines for authors. One, never, ever read longer than 20 minutes. 15 is better. 10 minutes if there are more than two authors on the docket. Practice reading in the privacy of your home using your microwave oven timer. Note that 20 pages does not equal 20 minutes. 20 pages, especially the two beautiful kind, go on forever. Once, when a fellow author was up at the podium and going on endlessly, I wrote the word time on a slip of paper and delivered it to his open book. He stopped. Two, eventually say, I'll take one more question, not because you're spent, but because the audience has had enough. Three, don't complain about anything from the podium. Anything. You had to get up at 5 a.m. to get here? Boo-hoo. There are MFA students and unpublished writers listening who'd be only too willing and grateful to set their alarms for any hour without belly aching. You complain that writing is such hard work and so lonely? You brat. Try digging ditches or disabling IEDs or doing 1,000 other harder things for a living. Four, buy some books yourself, especially those by today's unfamous and ignored. Tomorrow they'll win prizes.
That's great. That's wonderful. That was Eleanor Lippman reading from I Can't Complain, All Too Personal Essays. Do you have a favorite novel of your own besides the current one?
We don't say that. We don't say that. We don't, you know, it's the whole, like, favorite child thing. I do, you know, there's ones that I love that didn't get as much attention. I'm very fond, very, very fond of, my latest grievance was two books ago, and that the narrator is a young woman. I call it, she's sort of like the Eloise of a college campus. She was born and raised in a dorm. So it got lovely reviews and everything like that, but when people approach me, they almost always tell me that their favorite book of mine, or they started with The Inn at Lake Divine. So I think it would be my favorite, except it doesn't need my help. I feel like, yeah, you know, yeah, that's sold a lot of books. And it just got named last week, Real Simple invited authors, not me, to name a book that changed their life. And it was headlined 50 books, 50 must-read books that will change your life. And number five was The Inn at Lake Divine.
Hmm. Nice.
So I was completely thrilled about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was Emily Giffen, who was the author who recommended that. And I don't even know her, but...
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know her personally. I certainly know her work.
And we have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask you something that comes up in my class, or just came up recently in one of my classes. And as a student, you know, there's a lot of brainstorming that goes on in the workshops. And a student asked, it was an interesting question. I'm trying to remember exactly how she put it, but something to the effect of, how do you know when you're borrowing somebody else's words? I think it came out of brainstorming. Everybody was brainstorming. Mm-hmm. And she felt like it was cheating to take ideas from her fellow classmates who were offering her ideas for her book, because she felt like, well, it's not my idea, so am I stealing something? And I said, no, of course not. You know, brainstorming. We're brainstorming. Brainstorming is mm-hmm. a wonderful thing. It's sort of like your neighbor coming in and saying, the view from Penthouse B. Mm-hmm. What could you say to that? I mean, do you, at any point in your writing career or even now, do you find brainstorming helpful? Do you, you know?
I have an exact example of a book of mine that grew out of that. I mean, words... Certainly not. Not words, but if someone says, and usually the ideas are terrible, I should add. It's usually somebody at a party who says, hey, you know, I always thought, you know, here, you want to hear a story? It's always terrible. But in what happened to me was, I was trying to come up with an idea for a new book, and a friend of mine called and said, oh, I just saw in the newspaper that it was a headline that said, Ivana write a novel, and it was Ivana Trump wanted to write a novel, and my then publisher was looking for a ghostwriter. So I thought, well, I could, by the way, $1 million to write it. So I thought, oh, I could do that, I think. So I called my agent. It was like, well, you know, I don't think you have the right clothes, she said. And then she said, but I'll talk to the editorial director. So she saw him and she talked to him, and she said, she pitched it, and then he said, well, we love the work. We're looking forward to her next novel, not a ghostwritten one. So my agent said, the only thing is, I would love to read a novel by Eleanor about ghostwriting for Ivana Trump. So she told me that, and I thought, well, you know, that would be so reductive if I did that, took an idea. But in fact, Isabel's Bed became a story about a mousy ghostwriter. I like to do mousy characters because then I can, you know, sort of send them to charm school and like, make them happy. And she takes a job to be a ghostwriter for this, you know, sort of famous woman. And so I did that. But one thing I don't get quite is why someone gets great praise for, like, oh, this is a reinvention of Pride and Prejudice or Possession, or they take the plot or King Lear and then make a modern day story along those lines. I don't quite get that, why it is praised as being like, isn't it marvelous? This is a latter day, you know, King Lear. I don't get that. I don't get that.
Interesting. I wish we had. I wish we had more time.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, I wish we had more time. And I have one really, really quick little question before we close. Well, maybe two. And one is that regarding marketing, I notice you're on Twitter.
Yes.
So you tweet now and then. And so, what's your relationship with social media? I mean, do you feel that you should do a little bit or what?
Oh, well, right now it's sort of I'm like Twitter exhausted because for 500 days, I didn't know it would be exactly 500 days before the election, I did a rhyming tweet every day, every freaking day for 7 days a week. And I took off the two Yom Kippurs between in that like 15 months because I thought I could get away with that. So after 500 days in a row, minus two, I just now tweet when the mood strikes me or, you know, and my son writes me and says, Ma, you should be tweeting where your appearances are. And so I try to, you know, it's like self-promotion is, it doesn't come all that naturally. But then you see what other people do and then you think, okay, here's a link to that review, and I do that. And Facebook I do more regularly. So I'll just put on links to things, and you know, I don't occasionally, you know, here's my son's graduation picture from Columbia Business School that happened last May. So the occasional personal thing, but not too much. But I try not to think about how helpful it's supposed to be,
right?
Because my stomach starts churning.
Yeah, there's a lot there to make the stomach churn, for sure. Just in closing, any last words or any advice that perhaps you were given along the way that stuck with you and that you voice to others?
You know, one of the things that I learned, I mentioned Arthur Edelstein in Brandeis Adel Dead. He used to say, prepare to write badly. And what that meant was when you sit down in the morning and you feel like you don't have an idea in your head and you don't feel inspired, then just put some words down and prepare to write badly. I have author friends who don't like that, who disagree with me, but I think, you know, I revise and polish. So it's like the scaffolding, you know, it goes up and then it helps and then maybe it'll come down and never be a part of the building. And what else do I, another This is I like even more, and that is sometimes the best form of revision is to start something new.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a good one. I haven't heard that one before. That's very
mm-hmm.
good. Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah.
You have been wonderful, and your books are wonderful, so I thank you so much for taking the time.
You're so welcome. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. It was Eleanor Littman and her books. At least her current books are The View from Penthouse B and I Can't Complain, both published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and lots of others, and I'm going to be checking them out, and I hope you do too. That's all the time we have for today. If you want to know more about the show or the Pen on Fire speaker series, go to penonfire.com. Until next time, I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM in Irvine.